You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to a new edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded on the 27th of August, 2023. If you go to my website, rushjournal.org, or theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com, you'll see links to my Patreon. You'll see ways to donate to me, specifically that blue box, which is clickable, that says The Russian Orthodox Medievalist. And you know, any of that is certainly acceptable, and I appreciate it. Today we're going to talk about a topic that I've danced around before. I mention it quite often, but I'm going to get into it in great detail. And that's the concept of the old Moscow Patriarchate claiming that the Soviet Union was God established. Now, we all know who said that, or I should say who eventually said that, a Metropolitan, eventually Patriarch Sergius. More specifically, I want to talk about the New Testament comments suggesting that all power is from God and hence should be obeyed. The most famous, of course, is 1 Peter. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which is from God. The authorities that exist have been appointed by God. Consequently, whoever resists authority is opposing what God has set in place. Just as famous, probably, is Romans 13. Submit yourself, for the Lord's sake, to every human institution, whether to the king, to the supreme authority, or to the governors, those sent by him to punish those who do wrong. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorance of foolish men. And the third, Paul's letter to Titus, chapter 3, remind the people to be subject to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready to do whatever is good, to slander no one, to be peaceable and considerate, always gentle towards everyone. Rarely are those passages interpreted to mean that anybody who has power over you should be obeyed. Rarely has it been interpreted that way in the past, because there was really no abstract conception of power. Not to mention the huge difference between power and authority. The translation from the Greek seems to be authority rather than just power. A mugger with a knife has power over you. That doesn't in the least give a reason to obey whatever the guy says and not resist if that's possible. And I got inspired on this topic, an article by Boris Redkin from 2022, calling this, you know, the doctrine of a lawless power being from God as a heresy. Metropolitan Sergius forced this issue to the forefront of theology. So when you apply it to Soviet power, the doctrine that it is from God really is only one of the two elements of the Sergian heresy. The second one is the doctrine of the necessity of maintaining a rigid bureaucracy in the church. Now, I'm not going to talk about that part of it, but the two seem to go together. If you're going to defend the impossible, the Christian nature of the USSR, or the God-inspiredness nature of the USSR, you're going to have to clamp down on dissent. Now, most of you have heard of the Declaration of Sergius from 1927, which was one of the mobilizing documents, and in it, The Metropolitan Sergius offers his support to the Soviet government. He offers his loyalty to the Soviet government. The joys, successes, and failures of the Soviet Union are our own. And that is our civil homeland. Our duty is to be citizens of the Soviet Union, not only out of fear, but also in conscience, as the Apostle taught us. Now, that's an explicit reference to Romans 13. We can live in peace and quiet only by obeying legal authority, from 1 Timothy. Since that's not fully a political statement, I didn't mention it in the beginning. So he doesn't say directly in Russian or in any of the translations that Soviet power is from God. He does say it indirectly, though. And in the declaration, he doesn't just come out with it. A couple months later, or actually maybe a month later, August 19th, 1927, he goes farther and says, we must not undermine the authority of the Soviet power. We recognize the Soviet power as normal and legal, and we obey its decrees quite sincerely. Thus, activities against the Soviet power do not correspond to our interests. And then finally, we demand complete loyalty to the Soviet power. He says something similar. December 31st of that same year, he stresses the loyalty that he has towards the Soviet system, and hence the church should have towards the Soviet system. Now, there's a great book. It does not exist even remotely in English. It's called The Case of Metropolitan Sergius. And it's edited by Novoselov. And it came out in 1929, which is clearly no coincidence. And it's a series of essays written by various scholars, clergy, against Sergius and his declaration. I am not one of these people, as I've said before, that very pompously condemns Sergius for this. Now, he goes way too far. But it is very possible that if he didn't issue this, he and God knows how many more clergy would end up in a gulag. And I'd love to see any of us with that threat hanging over our head not do what Sergius did, as painful though it was. The problem is that Sergius didn't seem to be painful for him, because he just added to the poetry of near worship of the Soviet system, including both Lenin and Stalin. So the apostle, for example, Timothy, chapter 2, instructs us to pray for all people, not just for authorities. And yet our litany, and the liturgy, has a whole list of who we're to pray for. But Sergius will eventually come out and say Soviet power is from God. And it's in 1942, before he was patriarch, a message to the church in the Baltic states. He says, I will not remind you that a patriarchal church, starting with the late Holiness Patriarch Tikhon, and hitherto invariably recognizes the Soviet power established by God in the USSR. And that's from the Odintsov book from 2013. St. Tikhon did not put his seal of approval on the Soviet state, even under great duress. And of course, there you finally have that this is a God-ordained institution, the Soviet state and the party. Sergius says, and it's called in the message of Patriarch Sergius to the 26th anniversary of the Soviet state. And he says, let us pray more earnestly for our God-protected country and for its authorities, headed by our God-given leader. And even after the death of Sergius, the Moscow Patriarchate adopted a conciliar decree. The message of the local councils, of the most reverend archpastors, pastors, and all faithful children of the Russian Orthodox Church, they go so far as to demand non-hypocritical loyalty and obedience to the God-established Soviet authorities. Now, the exile group, the Russian Synod Abroad, or OCOR, in their 1933 response to all of this, they say, He, meaning Sergius, declared this Soviet power God-given, on par with any other legal authority. He especially often referred to the apostolic command to obey state authority as a divine institution, for there is no authority but not from God. That, of course, and then another variation of Romans 13. The council uses an interpretation by St. John Chrysostom in the 1933 reaction to Sergius. I'll quote that here in a minute, but it's not really about a specific power, but the principle of power, authority, and hierarchy. They use Theodoret about the general principles of power, and they even use examples like 1 Samuel, when Saul became an enemy of God, Hosea 4:4, kings and princes without God and his knowledge, and Gregory the Theologian, where sometimes a demon could control the king or the ruler. In the collection I just mentioned, there's a letter from a departed bishop, and it notes that the Apostle Paul in Romans 13 teaches us to obey not the higher authorities, but the powers that be, and it corresponds to the expressions in 2 Thessalonians, the restraining power. In other words, power is only power unless it's an authority. It's only an institution that we pray for and obey because it holds back and subordinates sin underneath it. And Peter says about the same thing in 1 Peter 2. Now remember, he also mentions that Romans was written in the year 58, in the calm years of Nero's reign, and not during his persecution. And Romans 13 couldn't possibly have meant a hostile authority, because Paul wrote about apostasy in 2 Thessalonians as a future event. So the apostasy has long come, and the Soviet state is the godless and apostate power, openly hostile to God. Another article towards a denunciation of Metropolitan Sergius in that same collection. They use the analogy of Julian the Apostate, with the understanding, of course, that Soviet power is far worse than any earlier form of persecution, whether it be pagan, and by pagan, usually Judaic and Islamic, which is also Judaic. And it uses Gregory the Theologian, his brother Caesarius, who was a doctor at the court of Julian the Apostate. And St. Gregory equates serving Julian a communion with idols, and he demands that he no longer acts as a physician in his court. In fact, Gregory and St. Basil have petitions, prayer for a uprising against the wicked Julian. And in fact, use an example of prayer for the overthrow of vile and blasphemous rulers. Same thing for the anathema, 1918. That sobor talks about godless rulers. Another, what an Orthodox man should know. Another essay in this. And St. Isidore of Pelusium, who comes up quite a bit in these discussions. And he writes in a letter, the saint writes in a letter to Dionysius, but if some villain seized power lawlessly, then we do not claim that he was appointed by God, but we say that it is allowed for him. Not to quote there. But power descends from God from top to bottom. Has to do with authority, not necessarily power. So the representatives of the clergy of Leningrad and Metropolitan Sergius, the argument then, in what an Orthodox man should know, is the rulers of the USSR are not an authority. Authority is a hierarchy, and it's not just when someone is subordinate to me, but I submit myself to someone standing above me, and that goes back to God, the source of all power. The same thing is in the novella, the sixth short novella of Justinian, that the kingdom and the priesthood come from the exact same source. And, the Greek tropaion of the cross, preserve your people in peace. They also mentioned in 1 Peter, as I quoted in the very beginning, there's an error there For this is the will of God, that we, by doing good, should stop the mouth of the ignorance of foolish men. Now, there is no we in the Greek text. It's not really about us. It's about the rulers. So that those who do good or silence, put a muzzle on the ignorance of insane people is the proper translation there. But throughout the passage, it said that one should not obey any authority, but only that which takes revenge on the evildoers and praises the good doers, since God can only will good things. Saying otherwise is insane. There should be a muzzle put on those who are insane. That's what it says quite explicitly. Athanasius of Sinai. His question and answer, this is number 65. He says, if the apostle says, but the authorities that exist are established by God, does this mean that every ruler and king is appointed by God? Answer, since God says in the law, I will give you rulers according to your own heart, from Jeremiah, we say that those rulers and kings who are worthy of such an honor are appointed by God, and those who are in their unworthiness are worthless. They are delivered either by the permission of God or by his will for the people who deserve it. So, that's similar to St. Isidore of Pelusium, because there is a question of illegal seizures of power, and the Bolsheviks certainly would fall under that. But he does say, and Athanasius says that rulers to be such should be worthy of such an honor. Now, the author, many of these, myself included, tends to think that Sergianism is a firm heresy for a bunch of reasons, and one of them is the abuse of St. Paul and others. I mean, after all, he was condemned by the Council on Exile in 1933, partially because of his claim that Soviet power is from God. But at the very end of 1927, Sergius himself demands loyalty, but he's talking about those who may want to separate from him. By 1927, it was happening all over the place. And he says, his so-called sobor, he says, the canons of our Holy Church justify a break with their legitimate bishop or patriarch in only one case, when he has already been condemned by a council, or when he begins to preach a deliberate heresy, also already condemned by a council. And, you know, it wasn't just Sergius. The very fact that he uses the word legitimate means that you can't separate if he's legitimate. That's the whole issue here. There are so many. Metropolitan Eulogius, Bogoliubensky, both 1933 and 1935. In fact, Ivan Illin wrote his article condemning just exactly what we're talking about here. And it was against his article, his personal defense of Sergius. So he wrote, this is in 1936. Illin says this, accordingly, and with this understanding, the words of the Apostle Paul, there is no power except from God, do not mean the unbridled use of power, but its binding and limiting. To be from God means to be called to the service of God and to carry out this service. It binds and limits its power itself. It does not mean that the authorities are free to do any base, abominable thing. Any sins and wickedness, whatever it does, everything will come from God, and everything will demand conscientious obedience from its subjects, as if by the voice of God. But this means that the power is established by God for doing good and fighting evil. And she must rule in this way, and not otherwise. And if she rules in this way, subjects are obliged to obey her conscientiously. That means, in his condemnation of Eulogius, one of Sergius' people, that this is a qualitative, not a quantitative command. You know, any passage like this, of course, as Illin himself says, there's two ways to approach it. Either the formal and literal sense, which is very dangerous, or in a spiritual sense, where the good of the church is the foundation of any interpretation. Protestants, of course, take the former route. Their nominalism and total lack of any Christian culture means that they have zero imagination. They're extremely prosaic. Orthodox people are surrounded by poetry morning, noon, and night. They're not. And especially when you reduce, you know, their nominalism and individualism, that's all they have, is the formal, literal sense of these words. But it also requires the least amount of imagination and understanding. If you don't know anything, then the literal interpretation is all you have. To be able to interpret something, the good of the church and in context and all that, that implies a tremendous amount of knowledge on your part. And certainly a command over logic. Now, there's also, and this is in the year 2000, the Moscow Patriarchate came out with its Fundamentals of the Social Concept. And they kind of glossed over this issue a bit, but they do mention it briefly. You know, in section 3, they do mention, you know, Romans 13, and they do mention 1 Peter 2, as I've mentioned already. And here's what it says, section 3-1. The apostles taught Christians to obey the authorities regardless of their relationship to the church. In the apostolic age, the Church of Christ was persecuted both by local Jewish authorities and the Roman state. This did not prevent the martyrs and other Christians of those times from praying for the persecutors and recognizing their authority. Again, the word authority is used. But you know, it's as if this debate never occurred. And then it goes on. 3.5, section 3.5, same place. A reservation is made about possible disobedience to the authorities, but this is not really about the fact that authority is from God or it's not from God. A direct contradiction of such possible disobedience to the commandments of Romans with its interpretation by Sergius, it can't be explained in any way. Either the formal literal interpretation is correct, in which case resistance is impossible, or resistance does have a role. So any previous statement of Sergius and the Soviet councils have been preserved in the Moscow Patriarchate. They're not going to contradict this, and they haven't contradicted it. And there's several more. After 1927, on the commemoration of the authorities, he does mention explicitly. Now, an article by Nikolai Smirnov, answer of Metropolitan Sergius to the letter of the archpriest, and February of 1928. He says, this commemoration introduced not an abolition, but a fulfillment of a church institution. This is the commandment of the apostle, sacredly observed by our church at all times, everywhere and under all governments, completely irrespective of whether they desire or do not desire this commemoration. Whether they believe it or not, we restore the commemoration of the authorities in order to remove the reproach from all of us, the Orthodox members of our church, as if we hypocritically recognize Soviet power, but in reality served its foreign enemy. So clearly, Smirnov's article is in favor of Sergius. In fact, it's called the answer of Metropolitan Sergius to one of the many letters from the archpriest. And but let me summarize just for our purposes here. In March 29th, 1928, was a provisional synod under him. And he has, other than what I just quoted, he has four arguments. The first, Optiatus of Milevius, is mentioned, who says, pray for kings and authority. Gregory the Theologian, who says they're obliged to pay tribute, obey all those in power. John Chrysostom, bishops are subject to imperial orders and sentences, even if they prescribe the deprivation of all property or expulsion from the fatherland. So they're claiming these are authorities. The second one, they say, in the most ancient apostolic liturgy, we find a prayer for the king and those who govern, for the whole army, that our situation may be peaceful. And they mention Tertullian, we pray for all emperors, although they torture us. Three, Polycarp of Smyrna, pray for kings, for the authorities, even for those who persecute and hate us, and for the enemies of the cross. Christians pray day and night for the well-being of the sovereign, the army, and the entire Roman Empire. And St. Cyprian says something similar, according to them. The fourth is another reference to St. John Chrysostom in his analysis of 1 Timothy 2. And they reference, in fact, Theophon the Recluse, commenting on Chrysostom. And he claims that they prayed for the authorities in church meetings and in public in order to show everyone in disgust, their disgust of the rumor spread about Christians by their enemies, that they are misanthropes, and that gathering especially from foreign enemies, they start sedition. So that's Theophon the Recluse talking about in the pagan era. But, you know, the comment of Bishop Theophon is a little strange, since Chrysostom was the official head of the church in Constantinople. There was no enemies attacking Christians there. No one was tracking them down. The apostle himself, in his epistle of that day, doesn't allude to anything like this. No one was tracking down sedition in meetings of Christians. Because, you know, the form of persecution in the pagan era usually came from Jews in the first place. But it was very sporadic. It was severe, but it was sporadic. Rome had a mission to fulfill, and that places it entirely out of the fact that Rome was chosen for God to appear means that there's something special there. And that's one of the reasons that some of their arguments fall flat. Now, most of these deal with prayers for the authorities and public services. Now, the ancient apostolic liturgies, John Chrysostom and 1 Timothy 2, Theophon exaggerated a little bit about Chrysostom, because in his own interpretation, he says in the morning how we pray for the whole world, for kings and all who are entrusted with power. But there's no doubt that Chrysostom, head of the church in Constantinople, prayed for the Christian emperor in authorities at daily services. It isn't like John Chrysostom they were heretics, but this wasn't quite, actually even remotely close to the situation in 1927. There's no reference to supporting anti-Christian authorities. The words of Chrysostom talking about church meetings or in public and everything else, there's not much record of that. And even John Chrysostom says, do you see that it's necessary to pray for the pagans too? Do not be afraid to pray for the pagans. If you need to pray for them, then it is obvious about heretics. You need to pray for all people and not persecute them. Well, that's not the issue, even though Sergius and his apologists will bring that up. Of course, there's private prayer for pagans and heretics, but it doesn't follow that this is a public matter. St. Ignatius, St. Polycarp, pray also for kings, for authorities and princes, even for those who persecute you and for the enemies of the cross, as I mentioned already. Nothing there in public. In private, this is perfectly okay. That's hardly the issue. So they're engaging in some equivocation. So that they may even cite the apostolic decrees or the apostolic canons. And one of them is, after this, let the deacon pray for the whole church and for the whole world, and all of its possessions, fruits of the earth, for priests, for rulers, for the high priest and king, for peace in the whole world. Now that's directly from the order of the liturgy of the apostolic canons, or the apostolic ordinances, I should say. But at the same time, in the apostolic decrees, section 4:13, it says, submit to every kingdom and rulership and what is pleasing to God as servants of God and punishers of the ungodly. Give them every due fear, every contribution, every quitrent, every honor, collection, and tribute. Such is precisely the ordinance of God. No one owes anything except the expression of friendship which God decreed through Christ. So in all the arguments that Sergius and his friends came up with, it's either a tremendous distortion, not the issue, or they're deliberately ignoring further testimony, as in the case of the apostolic decrees, apostolic ordinances. But the book, again, The Case of Metropolitan Sergius from Novoselov, I think the very first collection of articles against Sergius anywhere. And speaking of prayer, one of the articles is Moscow Document on the Changing of the Text of the Litanies. And the argument there, you know, Paul asks Timothy, does not order him to pray for everyone and for the authorities. You know, the example of Archdeacon Stefan is mentioned. Pagan emperors conscientiously cared for the welfare of the people. This is very different from the Soviet system. There was some truth in things like Stoicism, because many of the pagan emperors were just. We have an interest in praying for assisting them in earthly affairs. St. John Chrysostom says, I mentioned the sixth discourse on 1 Timothy. Warriors are exposed to dangers in campaigns for our good, and therefore prayer is required of them. But when Julian the Apostate was around, they prayed for his death because he was explicitly anti-Christian. Many of the pagan Roman emperors were not. Soviet power aims to destroy Christianity. In fact, even Jeremiah chapter 7 forbids praying for the godless. And the prayers for the admonition of the lost, it is applicable here. It is unacceptable to publicly commemorate non-Orthodox at divine services, but we certainly can do privately. The article on obedience to Metropolitan Sergius. And in this article, they mention St. Tikhon, and mentioning that he was quite disobedient, contrary to what Sergius said. Not only did he join the ranks of the disobedient, but he justified their disobedience, that is to say, their rejection of the Soviet system. And they give a whole list of examples in church history. And they conclude by saying, Christian obedience is not blindly following the first hierarch wherever he goes. There is no conceivable way, given everything else that's said, not only in the Old and New Testament, but in the patristic corpus, that someone has power over you, therefore his voice is the voice of God. Now, a document that came out of Tashkent, takes a different tack here. They say the commemoration in dungeons and in exile for our existing fathers and brothers is canceled. The commemoration of the civil authorities themselves, who deny all faith, is introduced. This is a new thing, embarrassing many consciences, and many other anti-canonical actions are being carried out. Something isn't from God if it seeks to eliminate God. Given the specific conditions of the Soviet system, not only it being Marxist, but Judaic, and the article against those who commemorate the authorities, the argument is simple. If you commemorate them, it demonstrates duplicity and hypocrisy. You're lying, because we're talking about, you know, how the litany goes. You pray for their armies, pray for their civil servants. The implication is that they're doing good things. If you say that in reference to the Soviet system, and this is, you know, in the midst of famine, the camps already existed, of course. It was a Jewish ruling class, and you're talking about their success. And they actually say, in its current form, prayer for the authorities is, quote, the stench of decay capable of causing only the righteous wrath of God, end quote. Another one, the second letter of the exiles from the Angara, they mention that commemoration of the authorities, while it doesn't violate any specific church rule, is still condemned by the voice of a Christian conscience. And the Christian conscience recoils at the idea that any entity with power over you, therefore, is the voice of God, or secondarily, that it's been established by God. Again, the Orthodox litany actually mentions the victory of the army and that they're doing good things. And there's another one, the voices of the faithful, about the commemoration of those in power. And they say that this commemoration is blasphemous. It's a blasphemous use of the liturgy, pretending that we're friendly to the God-destroying power. The formula of commemoration, like you have in every Orthodox liturgy, is just not applicable to the current authorities. You're affirming who you're praying for in that particular instance. Now, they may change the wording of the litany prayer, as, you know, Gregory and Basil did many years ago. And one of the reasons, and this from the Voices of the Faithful about the commemoration of those in power, gives an impression that the reason that Sergius promoted the commemoration of himself and the Soviet authorities, it's not about that. It's about a political investigation into those who disobey the OGPU. So Sergius, he says, you know, this is a new secret order to immediately convey in writing the reason and motives for not commemorating Sergius and the authorities, if for some reason they're not commemorated there. And then they go on to say, between the prayer for the Emperor Nero and the prayer for the Soviets, there's a huge difference in power. And they make this distinction. They say, we can and do pray for the salvation and direction of prostitutes to put them on the right path. But it doesn't follow that we pray for the success of the brothel. They say the current government was excommunicated from the church by Patriarch Tikhon on January 19, 1918. And it was confirmed by the decision of the council January 25th of that same year. Hence, commemoration of those excommunicated at the liturgy is blasphemy. A canonical study of the deeds of Metropolitan Sergius from the same collection. They say Soviet power, as an atheistic power, can be shocked by such prayers, and they do not need such prayers, openly considering any religion to be an opiate of the people. If the Soviet government needed the prayers of Sergius, then she herself would demand prayers from citizens, as she does in all other cases when she needs the services of Russian people. Now, you can pray for Soviet power, but it's a very, very different kind of formula. And the model would be prayers for the punishment of the regime under Julian the Apostate. The commemoration does have power, well-being in their undertakings. It is impossible to commemorate them as Sergius had demanded. You can anathematize the godless rulers of darkness of this world, but you know that's about as far as it can go. And, you know, it goes on to talk about, you know, the Soviet ideas, both moral and physical, are repugnant to Christianity. Previous persecutions were not systematic. Even under Islam, they had some conception of God and proper law. They did do good things. Pagans did good things all the time, not as pagans, but they were followers of natural law in many things. It is totally different here. It is completely different here. Using a citation like Romans 13 about concerning the ancient Roman Empire is not applicable to the 1927 USSR. There was no such thing as totalitarianism. You didn't have police forces of hundreds of thousands of people, mass armies, bureaucracies really didn't exist. The modern state didn't exist. You could even, you know, emperors like Decius or Valerian, who both died in war. And their enemies would have been far worse than the Romans were. They were defending the fatherland, not supporting pagan worship. It's two completely different things. The closest parallel, as I mentioned, is Julian the Apostate. And St. Basil talks about, you know, he went on a trip and Basil was praying that he not make it back, because his safe return would bring death to Christianity. Therefore, Sergius' formula is very similar, in fact, is far worse, because if it's added to the petition about, you know, Russia and its authorities, but it's not said what to pray for, this can't deceive anybody. We have to pray for something specifically, and that is their victory and well-being. Now, it's probably a bad idea to condemn the Soviet Union right in the liturgy, and there's no synod, at least outside of, within the Soviet Union, that's going to do that. But as far as the commemoration that Sergius had demanded, using Romans as the foundation, the doctrinal foundation, has no resemblance to prayers for, let's say, the Turks or prayers for the Roman pagan emperors. And because all states are appointed by God, we can pray for the Soviet state. But Sergius goes much farther than that and says that this is not just a God-established state, but for the good of the church, that the church has been built up. If you remember a few weeks ago, I quoted on the death of Stalin, the Moscow Patriarchate had said about him, and that he was Orthodox, and that he built the church up, and he protected the church from outsiders. Absolutely outrageous. So Sergius and his successors went way beyond claiming that, well, any power, therefore, is established by God. Any power whatsoever, and therefore, their well-being should be the subject of our prayers. So, there's a criteria. You see this in St. Isidore of Pelusium, the sixth short novella of Justinian. There is clearly a distinction between, or a criteria, of powers from God and power that's not from God. And let me summarize it here. Power that is not from God has some of these, if not all of these, qualities. Number one, power has been taken illegally, that is to say, by violence or deceit. Number two, it does not curb evildoers. It doesn't equip the state for just action, to give and to take away from each person according to their merit. And finally, it's not from God if it prevents the subject from turning to God, that is to say, persecutes the church openly. The Soviets did it systematically. The Soviets rejected everything good about the old Roman Empire. There was a strong sense of justice in ancient Rome, in ancient Greece. The church continued to grow under Roman control, despite the occasional sporadic and frenzied persecutions, which often weren't even from the Roman authorities. And of course, any illegal seizure of power suggests that it's not the will of God, but in fact, the will of man. Now, Isidore of Pelusium really only mentions the violent seizure of power. But you have epistles talking about the second and third, B and C here, well, number two and three here. St. Theophylact of Bulgaria, and it's similar here, on the Tsar's education, it's a work he did, in the Middle Ages. He compares a kingdom, a true kingdom, an authority, versus a tyrant, saying that the first sign of tyranny is that it comes with violence. Theophylact goes on about the power that is not from God, and he quotes Isidore of Pelusium. The tyrant is not from God because, unlike the king, he manipulates the law however he wants. And he does it shamelessly. He changes them, he cancels them whenever he sees fit, especially in his own personal interest. St. John Chrysostom, I mentioned I was going to quote him. Let me quote him here in full. This is volume 9 of his works, page 774, 777. He starts off by asking, authority is established by God, how can that be? And I'm quoting him now. Is every leader appointed by God? Not that I say, the apostle answers. I am not talking not about each leader separately, but about power as such. Others obey the circumstance that everything happens not by chance and arbitrarily, so that people rush to and fro like waves. I call this the work of God's wisdom. Therefore, the apostle did not say that there is no leader who would not be appointed by God, but he discusses in general about the essence of power. Since equality often leads to quarrels, God established many types of power and submission, such as between husband and wife, son and father, old man and young man, slave and free, etc. And anarchy is evil everywhere and causes disorder. There are countless blessings from authority as such. If they are not abolished, everything will perish. If they are abolished, everything will perish. Neither the city, nor the village, nor the house, nor the marketplace, or anything else will stand. Everything will be overthrown as the stronger will swallow the weaker. And this is, the common sense response here. Therefore, if legitimate authority is overthrown and anarchy is introduced, all that's going to lead to is the dominance of the stronger over the weaker. That is not from God. So he's given a list of things. This is how you know it's not from God. Hierarchy is part of natural law. Equality is what creates chaos, the idea that one man is identical to another one. But the main point St. John Chrysostom is talking about, and of course, you know, he's talking about Romans and all these scriptural citations. He's talking about power as hierarchy, as a part of natural law. It's the very institution of authority, not necessarily power. And that even if it isn't Christian, it can work very well to rationally order people's lives. The big parallel to the Soviet system is the American system, because it rejects any concept of natural law. Justice is what they say it is. That authority of any kind, if it maintains natural law, is necessary to prevent anarchy and hence the dominance of illegitimate people, the stronger over the weaker. Now, of course, the three marks that I mentioned above clearly all apply to the Soviet system. As mentioned, the third one, how do you know a system isn't from God? Because it prevents the subject from turning to God, in particular, persecutes the church. And the question is, to what extent can Christians be hindered by state action? Now, what's significant here is that this is a totalitarian regime. There was no such concept, you know, up until the 19th century. The Roman state was very small by comparison to the modern state. It had limited police powers, even in the city. Unlike the Soviet system, and certainly our postmodern system, where everything is on video cameras, you're followed everywhere you go. The state, in that case, can hinder even basic acts of justice, or even the very concept of justice. It can blot out. So, summarizing here, it comes down to the authority and Holy Scripture, as what we're talking about, is the basis of relations between the church hierarchy and authorities. And when you have programmatic statements like Romans 13:1, even the tiniest error in interpretation or translation could be deadly. The Greek and Slavonic concepts of negation, not or is not. So the meaning of the phrase, there is no power if not from God. You know, so the one that we're refuting here, the translation is, there is no power except from God. That's clear, formal, basic. The second is, there's no power if not from God, which really, it means there is no power unless it's from God. But the first one, there is no power except from God, is a problem. It violates basic grammar and the logical structure of the teaching. Because if you say all authority is from God, then what information can be added by the second part of the phrase? The existing authorities are established by God. The thing that makes sense is the second one. It's a transition from the general definition of the concept of authority in the sense of legitimacy before God. We're talking about legitimacy before God of contemporary Roman power to the Apostle Paul. So in that version, earthly authorities can be from God, and from God's permission, they could be lawful before God and still be pagan or Islamic or whatever. Now, I gave a list of ways that you know that authority is not, power is not from God. Here are four criteria as to how to tell when a power is from God and hence deserves our obedience. And there's four mechanisms, and this is really from Scripture, how this is communicated. The first is direct testimony by revelation or through a prophet, like you have in the book of Samuel. That you have a traditional autocracy, which you see in 1 Kings 8, 10-17. The third, hereditary succession, Luke 1:32. And the fourth is more abstract, and it has to do with the state's effect on the spiritual and moral state of the society. Now, I've, for example, have spoken of the Taliban in Afghanistan, how given the extreme chaos there, which is awful under any condition, the Taliban, since everyone there is Islamic, you have to have an Islamic movement that can be very, very strict and impose its will on what is a broken and atomized society. I don't care that they're Islamic. Of course, I reject Islam in every way. But from the point of view of a legitimate authority, that's about as close as we're going to get there. You can't put an Orthodox czar in Kabul. That doesn't make sense. No one even know what that is. Islam, a different story. And we could see, you know, they're banning drugs and all that, that the moral status of the society is getting better. And it hardly even matters what the foundation is, so long as the results are there. Of course, in America, everything is getting worse. In the Soviet Union, everything just got worse. So, when you have the fourth one, the spiritual and moral state of society, you can use that for the pagan Romans. You can use that for the Taliban. You can use that for the Iranian authorities. Yes, of course, they're not Christian, but they are certainly from God for a whole bunch of reasons, not just moral reasons, but resistance to liberalism and all this other stuff. The vulgarity of the phrase, all power is from God, it boggles the mind. Only a Protestant could believe something stupid like that. And this is a very common Protestant talking point. God, the Jehovah's Witnesses even use it. But if all power is from God, then there's no such thing as an enemy. Someone seized power in Russia by force, whether a revolution or a war, or whatever. It was a conspiracy. What's the enemy? If Tsar Nicholas was from God, then those who overthrow him can't be. Which, the one who was overthrown or the one established after the overthrow, which is from God, or both at once? It's difficult for them to be both at once because they're complete polar opposites of each other. And when the Masonic conspirators who overthrew the throne, you know, the white government, the provisional government, the Bolsheviks then overthrew that. So you have a rapid succession of powers, quote, from God, completely different from each other. So who's the enemy? Who's the enemy of the fatherland here? Which one is from God? But if you're going to maintain the Protestant ideal, all power is from God, therefore anyone who opposes this, and that includes the power of invaders, conquerors, occupiers, must oppose, be opposing God's command. And opposing himself to the God-established powers is sin. That means that, let's say, the Serbian and Greek revolutionaries of the 19th century that threw the Turks out of the Balkans were sinning. They weren't just doing the wrong thing. They were destroying a power that existed from God and hence is legitimate. And that's really the crux of the matter. Something is established by God, therefore we should obey it, therefore it's legitimate. But what else is there other than the will of God? Well, the will of man. That's the whole concept here. We're talking about empires that were imposed by the will of man. Liberating an area of a non-Christian power by a Christian power. There's no question as to who the enemy is and who the good are. Anybody, you know, there's no such thing as an invasion anymore because this power coming in is equally from God. And resisting it is not only futile, but it's sinful. Finally, and this is a pretty common one, if all power is from God, that means the power of the Antichrist will also be from God, and hence we obey. Satan himself, in Luke chapter 4, he said, I'll give you power over all these kingdoms and their glory, for they are devoted to me, and I give it to whom I want. That seems to imply that Satan has control over these cities and states, suggesting there that whatever Satan controls, we cannot obey. And it's not even indirect. That would be a direct support of a satanic power. The pagans and the Muslims, for all their destruction and all the evil that they committed, they weren't absolutely dedicated to the destruction, not just of Christianity, but any religion whatsoever. There was some truth in them. And depending on the leader, some more than others. That's a huge distinction. Versus something along the lines of a totalitarian system that solely exists under a totally different rubric to destroy the concept of the soul, the spirit, any religion whatsoever that isn't based on a machine. So even trying to use St. Paul or Titus or any of these to justify the Soviet system under Sergius or even the present system, which is systematically at war with the concept of God through all kinds of conspiratorial means, including things like stolen elections and, violence in the cities, bringing in immigrants as a revolutionary force and all this stuff. These aren't authorities. They do have power. Although the person who, the state who has power often isn't the power. It's like in Renaissance, Florence. The Republican institutions were controlled by the Medici Bank. So which power is from God? Is it the legislature, or is it the banks that control the legislature? In other words, it leads you into absolute absurdity. As far as Sergius goes, it seems to me that if you have to rely on Romans 13 or 1 Timothy 2, if you have to rely on that, chances are you're not legitimate. Normally, a government, when it's defending itself, talks about all of its successes, talks about the virtue of its leader, of its leadership, the freedom, the growth, the happiness, the moral improvement, all that. That's, improved under the government. Normally, they won't say, well, Paul says that we're an authority, therefore you have to obey it. That's like a parent saying, because I'm the father, that's why, which I've never uttered in my life. The simple distinction between power and authority is important. Because in the scriptural passages that we started off with, 1 Peter, they actually mention that the state that they're talking about does good. You want to be unafraid of the one in authority, he says. Then do what is right, and you will have his approval. It assumes that it's a legitimate government because he will support you for doing just acts. We know that that wasn't the case in the USSR, not merely because it was unjust, not merely because it was a secret Judaic conspiracy, but also that they rejected the concept of justice. Society was going to be one big machine. Now, Peter says, so if you do the wrong thing, you should be afraid, for he, namely the monarch, does not carry the sword in vain. Well, the Soviets did carry weapons in vain. Doing the right thing is what made you afraid in the USSR. Can you say of the Soviet Union that the party was God's servant, that the party was an agent of retribution to the evildoer? Of course not. They were the evildoer. And then the conclusion from 1 Peter, therefore, it's necessary to submit to authority, not just to avoid punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes. And he says that explicitly here, St. Peter. And so that takes care of the, give the Caesar what is Caesar's. It's interpreted right here. If, no matter what kind of authority it is, if it is just, in many very important ways, then they should be obeyed. Because natural law says that some governing authority supporting hierarchy is part of natural law, part of human nature. So we can't just say that it's a power put over us, therefore we have to obey it and pretend that that's actually what St. Paul says or St. Peter says. Peter, 1 Peter, he says, you pay taxes because the state is good. For the authorities are God's servants who devote himself to this work. That's the context of what Christ earlier, you know, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, God what is God. Give taxes to whom taxes are due, which of course is what Christ is saying there. But that implies that we owe them something. Well, you don't owe a secret conspiracy anything. It's illegitimate just from its very origin. Even in Titus, Paul's letter to Titus. Remind the people to be subject to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to do whatever is good. Hence, the good is represented by the state. Obedience to authority is a good. It isn't good to support a satanic movement. It's a blatant contradiction, because the normal goal of a group like this is to destroy those who are obeying. And all of the articles in whether it be Redkin's article or the case of Sergius Novoselov's collection in 1929, all revolve around these, what really amount to common sense responses to the absolutely vulgar belief that because someone has power, therefore they have a right to use it on you. And how far could that possibly go? I gave the example of a mugger, or a bad doctor, for example, or a phony doctor who's giving you all kinds of, you know, you find out, my God, this guy didn't go to med school. You know, it's like The Simpsons. This guy didn't go to med school, but he has power over me because he's a doctor. Well, no, he's not a doctor at all. Therefore, he doesn't have medical power over you. A conspiracy creating a totalitarian system is not an authority. As St. John Chrysostom says, it's what happens when authority goes away. Of course, to be literal about the Romans passage, you have to say that even anarchy itself and the gangs that end up controlling different areas, that that's equally legitimate as the authority that may take over and impose itself afterwards. No matter how different they are, no matter how opposing they are, no matter how anti-God they are, they are established by God and hence are legitimate. I'm not even talking about governments used as a punishment. That is not what's being discussed here. The one good thing about the Soviet system is that it forced Russians to cling to the church, not just perfunctory, but in a real way where they didn't take it for granted anymore, as Seraphim Rose would say. That doesn't have anything to do with whether or not it's legitimate. There's always something good that comes out of everything. Nothing's purely evil. But even if that were possible, Protestants would say we have to obey it. In other words, we have to then become a part of the destruction of the church. That was not the case in pagan Rome when Paul wrote what he wrote, or Peter wrote what he wrote. It doesn't apply to something that didn't exist at the time. And what didn't exist at the time is a totalitarian, anti-religion, anti-everything power, justice, right, natural law, rejected by both liberalism and Marxism. That didn't exist. And I've said this before about many issues, that we live in unprecedented times. Therefore, just throwing out canons and throwing out, you know, one-liners isn't going to cut it. Rome, ancient Rome, was a utopia compared to the Soviet Union, compared to 2023 United States. These may have been, they may have been wrong about certain things. The regime, however, wasn't evil. The Jews who took over Russia knew exactly what they were doing. They had no intention of helping workers or farmers. The point of the Soviet system was to take the entire wealth of Russia and hand it over to the people who control the party, which is what a command economy has to do. They control everything. Therefore, they own everything, or at least practically own everything. That was the point of the revolution. Anyway, I think I've made my point here. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you for donating. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.